in a world where everyone knows everything.
Yeah, right.
One dad stands below everyone and yells, I know nothing.
Please welcome.
This is the Dad Who Knows Nothing podcast.
Well, welcome. This is the Dad Who Knows Nothing podcast. I'm very excited to have Gregory Ann Cox with us today. She is a certified life, weight loss, and health coach for women over 50 who want to take a rebellious approach to aging. And in fact, her website is rebelliouswellnessover50.com. And she has a podcast of her own by the same name, Rebellious Wellness Over 50. So a different approach, and thought it would be great to have her on the podcast because obviously all dads are, you know, we all have women in our lives. And as we all age, they all age as well, whether it's parents or spouses. And so I thought Gregory would be great to come on board and talk to us about what she does for her clients and how she's helping people age better. So thank you for being with us, Gregory.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Dad Who Knows Nothing.
Now, do you prefer Greg or Gregory?
Yeah,
or
Greg is fine.
Greg, okay. Yeah. My brother's name is Greg, so and I have one of those names as well as Dana that can be either way. So very nice. All right, so tell my listeners how you got to this rebellious wellness over 50. What was your journey to get to the here for your life's work?
I have had to think about this over the past few years because it is a great question. I ask it on my podcast too. I love the journey that people, and many women, probably some men too, are starting a whole new life at 50, right? Changing what they may have been corporate, maybe they stayed home and now they want to do something different. So I would say that my journey has its roots in food and wellness, but not directly. And my first career was, as I said to you earlier, I was a chef. I went to the Culinary Institute of America and paid my dues and worked my way up, and that was it. And I always had a desire to cook healthy food. The genesis, though, I think was I came in both rebellious. I mean, I came into the world rebellious in some ways, although an obedient. I mean, I had to be obedient. Mom was strict and the nuns were strict at Catholic school. But I always wanted people to have their full expression, and I wanted to be fully expressed. And that was often problematic with the nuns, but I managed to survive. When I was a teenager, and I wanted to be a doctor. So that's this helping piece. Literally, I used to, you know, like so many probably little girls, doctored my dollies and my teddy bears. And then younger brother and sister came along. I tried to doctor them. Sometimes that was helpful, sometimes not. But I didn't go to medical school because my chemistry teacher in high school said, you're not good at science. Probably won't make it as a doctor. Should not probably have listened to her. But by the same token, she said, you're really good with language. And I was, and I am. And so I went and I did psychology, not medical school, but still using the language and of people. And my mom got sick with pancreatic cancer when I was 19, I think, and subsequently died. And during that time, she was alive for a year. I remember reading all of these health books from, you know, like hippie kind of health books, like Back to the Land, and, you know, trying to figure out what we could do to help her, juicing, supplements. Of course, there wasn't anything. But I saw that the impact, the trying to help her, wanting to help her, was almost good medicine for her, right? She felt like somebody was doing something. So then that, you know, kind of added a layer, like it didn't work, but maybe it could. And then when I was a chef, I moved to California and I got to work for a heart surgeon. And he wanted to start a heart healthy restaurant. We actually did the first heart healthy restaurant in the country. And he allowed me, he invited anybody from the corporate team to stand in the OR with him when he did a bypass surgery. And since I wanted to be a doctor and blood and guts doesn't bother me from kitchens, you know, somebody's always cutting themselves, I jumped at the opportunity. And when he took the heart out and held it in his hand and showed me what normal fat on a heart muscle looks like, we have to have a little fat to protect us from the bones and the structures inside. And then there was the fat that the woman, her lifestyle had added, and how slow and almost non-existent the pulse was in her heart, the electrical current in her heart was. Miraculous that we have heart surgery. I have no problem with the idea of heart surgery. People get it when they need it. But in that moment, when they did the surgery, put the bypass, all the different, hooked up the new arteries, veins, whatever they are, and the heart started beating like crazy, he said to me, 60% of my patients do not have to endure this surgery if they only can change the way they live. That was 30 years ago. Today, the number is 80%. 80% of people with lifestyle diseases have some say in how they experience health or illness. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's possible. So all of these things together, I finally got tired of cooking and I said, what can I do? And I got certified as a life coach. Then I was going through my own perimenopause and I had a blog and I was writing and I had a newsletter and people kept asking me, well, what are you doing? You know, I was just writing generically, I guess, about women's health. And that sort of just like the audience called me to start reporting on what I was doing, what I was reading, what I was researching. Then I started doing expert series, like 10 or 12 experts at a time, bringing more information to women. And so here I am. It just one thing sort of led to another, to another, to another.
Got it. So it built up over time and kind of centered you and provided you that that tunnel into where you felt like you could have the biggest impact. So I want to really lean into the rebellious piece, because I think that there's so many, you know, nutrition coaches, fitness coaches, wellness coaches, the coaching industry is, there's so many, yeah. But when I look at yours and I see the word rebellious, there's not too many that lean into that term when they're talking about, you know, health and wellness. So what does it look like to be rebellious in your approach to health? And why did you kind of go that direction?
Well, I think I always had when my mom got sick there, and you know, this was very early days, many, many years ago, for what they knew medically about pancreatic cancer and what to do. And so there was surgery that they maybe shouldn't have done, which made it work, you know. So I started to get a little bit of a mistrust. And as I said, I kind of came in rebellious. I always wanted to dig deeper than what the party line was putting out there. And over the years, I've seen that I say it's an act of rebellion to stand for the kind of health care you want in your life. It's easy to follow the Western medical model, but we know from looking at the population numbers of heart disease and some cancers and diabetes, that not only don't they know how to feed people, the Western medical model, it's an emergency care system.
Right.
It's not a wellness care system. So the rebellious part is, if you don't like a diagnosis that requires medication, like, okay, your blood sugar is high, we're going to put you on metformin, which isn't the worst drug in the world, but your blood pressure is high, rather than saying, for 6 weeks, I want you to go home and try to do something, right away there's medication. If that doesn't feel like a fit, I want people to feel courageous enough to say, you know what, I'm going to go find a little information to support my desire to not be on medication or to not have a procedure if you don't want, even testing, you know, do we really need a colonoscopy after 50 every, I don't know how many years it is, but there are alternatives, right? So all that is what the rebellious part is. It's not to say that we won't use Western medicine. It's to say that, or even, never mind, not use it. When we want to use it, and somebody says, this is what happens at your age, so there's no reason for us to even do any diagnostics. That makes my head pop off. I mean, people get dismissed, women especially. It's proven that women get less care than men in certain situations. Women of color get less than white women. It's, you know, all across the board, there are places for improvement. So I help women see what the alternatives are, and then they make their own decisions with or without the help of a coach, somebody guiding them.
Got it. Yeah, I definitely agree that, you know, the Western side of health is take a pill to deal with the symptoms or to lower whatever reading is that's too high or something that's too low. And because for the most part, we've been brought up in this side of the world to, that's an easy way out, right? If I take a pill, then I can keep doing what I want to do, instead of maybe making some better decisions that would eliminate the need for that.
Yes.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, and I think that that awareness is now growing. And I think that's why you see so many wellness coaches and nutritional coaches, because people are understanding. I was listening to someone the other day that really was doing a deep dive, a doctor, into food as medicine and how much it can serve as a medicine for us. And we don't think of food that way, at least on the Western side.
Exactly. And I think sometimes people who may have been, maybe it's suggested, well, if you changed your lifestyle, things could get better. Well, what does that even mean, lifestyle?
Right.
And if you change your eating, well, then there's like, we should eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day. No, we should eat 9 fruits and vegetables. We should eat 11 fruit. Don't eat these kind of vegetables because they have lectins in them. You know, there's so much confusing information out there. And not to say that I don't add to it, right? I have my own spin. I bring my own experts and I put more noise into the marketplace. But what I want people to come to any podcast or book or coach with is an awareness of how they feel and how they want to feel, right? If you don't feel the way you want to feel or how you used to feel, what's the one thing you think is the reason? We are super, super smart inside. Our gut, whatever you want to call it, usually gives us clues. And when people say, I don't know how to listen to my body, you do, you're just not used to. Like you said, we're not used to thinking of food as medicine. We're not used to listening to the signals our body gives us. But we're intuitively pretty smart. And if you ask somebody, what do you think is the one reason? They might cite food, they might cite poor sleep, they might cite too much stress. That's a starting place. So if they think of this before they go and listen to people and take other people's advice, it will either resonate or it won't, because they know where they're starting from.
Yeah. And I think too many times we, as people, we want to just take whatever fad or cookie cutter approach works and people have had success. So then they go on that type of diet or they do that type of thing. And whether it's intermittent fasting or keto or whatever the buzz diet is, but the reality is that everyone really is different with what things work for them. Now there may be generalities that overall will work, but even within them, you know, tweaking different things to work for you is because there's a cost element. There's a normal being, you know, not liking a particular food that can play a huge role. No one's going to be successful if they're being told every day you have to eat this food that they absolutely hate when there are other alternatives. So that's a great point.
True for movement. You know, people say, well, you should start walking or you should start running or you should do kettlebells or, you know, and people get excited about doing something new and, you know, go buy the equipment, whatever. If the forethought wasn't there about, will this fit into my lifestyle?
Right.
Do I have a gym nearby? Am I willing to buy these things and do them in my own house? Do I have room? Do I have time? When do I schedule it? And I know that a lot of us, myself included, don't like to think about all the minutiae, right? I'm excited right now. Just let me go buy the kettlebells or buy the Peloton, which I did, and I absolutely love my Peloton. But it is an individual thing. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't want to run. I'm not a runner. Or I don't want to bike. I don't want to dance. Just pick something that you do like that will fit your lifestyle.
Yeah, the key is to just do something to stay active. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the, you know, I'm on a program that I'm doing for my fitness. And one of the things that I said to my wife, who has a Peloton and she loves it as well. And
five Peloton.
I said to her, I said, one of the things I like the most about my program is that when I would go to the gym, you know, you could go online and get any type of YouTube or any type of thing that tells you, hey, these are exercises you could do at the gym. But I didn't know, you know, what to do, when to do it, what days to do what. And just the fact that someone has established a program where I don't need to think about it, I just go and do it. Mm-hmm. And that to me, we were talking about this before we started about the difference between men and women, mm-hmm. right? For me, it's like, tell me what I'm supposed to do and I'll do it. And I tell my wife this all the time too. I have I'm working the insurance industry for my normal job, 9 to 5. And it's not a backbreaking industry. So on the weekends, you know, we have a big property. We do things around the house. And I tell her all the time, I'm like, just tell me where to dig, tell me where to push, tell me what to carry, you know, so that I don't have to think about it, because I do a lot of the thinking and making decisions during the week. And so that's what I love. And that's, is that part of the services that you provide, giving them that advice and guidance?
You know, I definitely give people guidance. I wouldn't say I give people a plan, because people used to say, can I have the recipe for that? I am the worst. I was a chef in the food industry for 27 years. I'm the worst. Don't ask me to do a recipe, because we don't use recipes. I mean, if I'm baking, I use a recipe, because most baking is more scientific. But I will give people like guidelines, protein and fat at every meal and snack. If something makes you tired, take it out of your diet for 7 days. Let's see what's happening, right? Because if I give people a meal plan, and like you said, you like having a plan. Some people want to know, what do I eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Great. I can recommend people who do that. I don't do it, because what happens if you don't have the broccoli or the tilapia or the tuna or whatever it was that it said? Then a lot of people feel like they failed if they just eat something off program. And again, that is counter to my rebellious streak. I don't want people to feel boxed in. But I definitely give them guidance, and I have lots of people I can refer to if people really just, they want to stick with a program.
Yeah, and I probably put you on the spot there, but when it comes to diet and eating, I'm the same way. I want guidelines. I don't want someone telling me what I have to eat every day. There are people in the program that I'm a part of that they say, hey, it's easier for me if I just, you know, they do all the pre-meal and they plan it, they make it all before for the week. And there's benefits to that. And I've done that in the past, but I don't like having it be the same meal every lunch. I like to have, you know, the different variability. And I think food gives us that, which is nice.
Absolutely. And plus you get more nutrition with a varied diet.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some days that I just don't want egg whites. I mean, I just want to, you know, I want to try. Yeah. Well, of course, I want the egg. I want the yolk. And so, all right. So cholesterol is something that is always a big topic when you're talking about health. If you go to any doctor, blood tests, they're always going to check your cholesterol. I myself have had a doctor tell me that my LDLs are too high. And have prescribed medication. And I've since, you know, tried to make some lifestyle changes where I don't have to take that medication. So cholesterol, good thing or a bad thing? Give me your take on cholesterol.
Cholesterol is an important nutrient for every single cell in the body. Both HDL, people might say the happy is the H, and the LDL is the low life. I can't remember what the L stands for, lousy maybe. They both have different jobs in the body. The LDL is responsible for going out and finding places to be utilized, and synthesis of vitamin D. If we don't have enough LDL cholesterol, or you know how important vitamin D is, right? Synthesis of vitamin D is less. Sex hormones don't run as well without the right amount of cholesterol. All kinds of things are needed. So anyway, LDL goes out into the body, finds places that need it, settles in. HDL is like the cleanup crew. Goes out from the liver, around the body, to pick up the waste products that LDL might cause when it does whatever it's doing. Byproducts, waste products, and extra LDL brings it back to the liver to be metabolized again. So if the body is smart, we all think it was pretty miraculous, right? It heals, babies grow, all kinds of things get mended that were broken. Why would this one aspect of health, this one molecule, be poison to the body if everything else is so smart, right? So the simple answer is we now have ways to test the type, the particle size of LDL and HDL. If you want to get a VAP, V-A-P, any of your listeners want to understand what kind of cholesterol is running around in their body, which is where this is where it gets important for people that have heart disease or are, you know, maybe going to have heart disease because they have markers, inflammation, that kind of thing. If you have light, fluffy particles running around in your system, they're just going to bounce. They don't cause any problem, light and fluffy. the small, dense little particles in LDL and HDL are the ones that will get stuck in an artery that's nicked, in a little tiny piece of something sticking out, right? So you can imagine your, you know, I don't know what kind of like popcorn maker gets stuck and all popcorn's backing up. Well, then you're going to have a machine breakdown, right? That's where problems happen in the arteries. They get blocked. They can't circulate all the blood and oxygen, is because these little dense particles build up. HDL also patches up things that aren't doing well, right? There's a nick in an artery. HDL is like, it likes to make things better. That combined with small particles could cause too much to narrow, too much patching. So then the artery narrows. So it is neither good nor bad, but it is meant to be good in the body. And then some things go wrong. The interesting thing is 50% of people that have a heart attack have normal cholesterol, and 50% have what would be considered high to really high. When they do autopsies on people that die of heart attacks, the same thing is true. So cholesterol on its own is not the devil. We really have to get the bigger picture and look at our triglyceride levels, markers like C-reactive protein, what's the inflammation level, what's our A1C number for blood sugar. All of these things together are a better predictor of whether somebody's headed for a heart attack or a stroke than just isolating cholesterol. And cholesterol drugs, statin drugs, for women are not as effective, and really not real. They're not great for women's metabolism. I have a two-part article on my blog at rebelliouswellnessover50.com/blog that talks all about statins and women and who it's designed for and who they are good for. I'm not saying they're not good for anybody, just that I think they're overprescribed at this moment in time.
Getting back to our earlier conversation about, you know, take a pill to fix because there's a level that's a little high. So it sounds like, so it's necessary things in the body, but then there's a potential risk where if certain things happen altogether, that it could potentially cause a problem. But to your point, there's generally a ton of factors that are going into causing that issue.
Exactly. You know, there's a small percentage of the population that has something called hypercholesterolemia, which means they always have a super high, like over 300 for their LDL or their combined, I forget. Those people most likely need a medication to keep them safe, because that much running around is probably going to cause problems. But other than that, most average everyday humans, and I just quoted, I can't remember where it is right now to put my hand on it, a doctor who's a cardiologist I was listening to and read in his blog, he said, we still don't know. We cannot prove how much effect the foods we eat have on our cholesterol levels. We cannot prove a direct link between an egg yolk and a cholesterol molecule. And I think that's really fascinating today, 2022, because for years, until this latest science, maybe he'll have some headway, most docs will say, don't eat the egg yolk, cut out shrimp, get rid of the cheese, all these things. And there's, you know, a lot of good to be said for the fat. The yolk has an incredible amount of nutrition.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by egg yolks, because the yolk itself, I mean, it's literally where a life is formed and is created. So the nutrients in there, think of what it's forming. It's forming a brain. It's forming an actual animal. All right, let's switch gears. So Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
That's something that's prevalent, obviously, and a risk for some people more than others as they age. Can you talk about the relation between Alzheimer's and the female brain?
Yes. The best book on the subject, in case anybody wants really deep dive, is a book called The Double X Brain, the XX, which would be the female DNA profile, right? Lisa Moscone is the scientist who wrote the book and is leading a team of scientists over at Cornell Weill Medical Center in New York City on the female brain and Alzheimer's and dementia. And she writes, I did another two-part series of this on my blog, that estrogen is one of the defining issues when it comes to brain health and women, the declining estrogen levels equal a decline in certain types of brain function, memory, all these things. Then the body wants to keep estrogen going, so it puts on fat because fat cells can have an estrogenic effect. Women don't want the extra fat, so they try to lose weight, and so then they diminish the estrogen. Anyway, it's this crazy circle. But she said also that people that get tested for the APOE 2, 3, and 4 for the genetic marker for Alzheimer's, just because you have that doesn't mean you're going to present with Alzheimer's. And every 3 people in the world that get Alzheimer's diagnosis, 2 are women. She also said for the first time, they now added Alzheimer's to the lifestyle diseases like diabetes and heart disease that are influenced by lifestyle. And although I said 80%, she says 90% of lifestyle diseases. I mean, lifestyle is affected by 90%. Now, I've interviewed genetic researchers as well and scientists. Their window is a little bit wider. They say anywhere between like 20 and 25% of how we age is genetically responsible, is responsible for how we age. One woman, I'm trying to think of her name, a doc, she always says that genetics is the gun and we load the chamber, right? Genes are there. They're waiting for us to tell them what to do. They are not stamped in stone for the most part. So in a nutshell, what she says is, although women are more likely, percentage-wise, data-wise, what we have right now, to be diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's, not very, very few have the genetic marker. But what happens is lifestyle causes changes in the brains of women differently than men because this estrogenic protection is gone. Now, if a woman takes bioidentical hormone replacement, that's a safe way to restore estrogen levels to a brain and cardioprotective level. So it's complicated, but it is, we get diagnosed more often than men.
Got it. So it's amazing how many things, you know, come down to lifestyle and how.
Oh, I wish it wasn't so.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a cheeseburger and french fries for dinner than salad, but you know.
So you mentioned genes, and I love the title of your book, Your Genes Do Not Determine the Size of Your Genes. I think that's such a great title. So how do they, you mentioned, you know, the analogy of the gun. Can you talk a little bit more about how they affect us as we age?
Let me start not so much how they affect us as we age, but how little they are responsible for who we are as an aging population. So the number one scientist, cell biologist, Dr. Bruce Lipton, many years ago when he was still a cell biologist, he discovered that the cells that he was working with in their petri dishes were influenced as much by what he put in the petri dish by the environment around them. That he could cause stress, he could cause them to die, he could cause them to be happy by playing music, all these things. So then he thought, well, if that's true in the petri dish, maybe it's also true in humans. So he went, you know, animal studies, human studies, and found, as we've been talking about, that maybe 20%, 25% is a genetic reality for us. Height, weight, height, eye color, hair color, you know, that kind of thing. And then we influence the rest of the genetic. It's like we have a genetic potential waiting, as I said, to get for us to give directions to those genes to express themselves or to turn off, to lie dormant. Now, within that, saying that, there are moments in a person's life where they have all the best genes, everything's going fine, bam, they drop dead of a heart attack. Couldn't see it coming. Or bam, they have some you know, they tested negative for APOE4, but they have early onset Alzheimer's. Genes go rogue without our help, but that's a very small percentage of the population, like 2%. I don't think I have it on hand. There's another book by a woman who was one of the first genetic researchers in Great Britain. And she worked with children with Down syndrome. And that's where she based all of her work. And then they went to cancer research and all this stuff. And she said that she was the one that talked to me about these rogue expressions of genes. But we shouldn't focus on the rogue ones because there's nothing we can do about those. What we should focus on is the 70, 80, or maybe even 90% of potential for aging well that we have within our power, because they are not set in stone. Our health and wellness is not set in stone by the genetic profile we came in. I mean, you've probably heard of twin studies where they take a set of twins. Maybe they got separated, you know, when they were 7 or 8, maybe they got separated, maybe they stayed together, and they're completely different human beings. One is moody, one is always happy, one is sick, one is not, one is smoking, one couldn't stand the smell, right? So even twins, identical twins, have different expressions of their health, wellness, mood, potential. Oh, so that's what I meant by that. The title was that your genes, because I used to hear women when I was coaching them say, well, everybody in my family gets fat at menopause. Or all of my sisters are heavy, so I probably will get heavy too. And that's when I discovered Bruce Lipton, and then I started studying that, and I just thought, I don't want people to suffer under that illusion, because if we don't think something's going to work, we won't look for a solution or something to help us, right? We just shut down.
So what is the best response, and how have you been successful in working with individuals who may have had that predisposed feeling about, you know, that they're going to end up a certain way?
A lot of coaching is mindset work. As a matter of fact, all health coaching is life coaching. It's mindset. It's what we believe about ourselves, what we believe about our potential. It's about what we believe health-wise. So in the case of one woman that I'm thinking about, she had 4 sisters, all older than she was. And she was maybe 40. She hadn't gained, a couple of pounds. Maybe her blood sugar was a little high. But she had this story that, why bother? Because it's all going to go to hell in a handbasket. And it's not like she was sitting on the couch eating bonbons. You know, she was working and active. But she just, you know, she thought, and then I'm going to go on medication and my sisters. So not only did I help her with I just wanted her to say, maybe that doesn't have to be me. And what would be different for you if that wasn't your destiny, let's say. And so we did some, you know, sort of life planning, like in 5 years, if you weren't going to get fat and get diabetic, what would you do? What would your life look like? And then not only was she so excited about the possibility that she got one of her sisters to become a client of mine, who was probably 30 pounds overweight, closer to 48 or 49, perimenopausal, miserable, but resigned to like, oh, well, I'll be a fat granny. And, you know, nowadays, even saying I don't want anybody to feel like I have a fat thing. Fat is whatever, you know, if a BMI, I don't believe in BMI, but if somebody wants to say I'm fat about themselves, I would say, please don't live that. Don't live in that. Live in, I want to be healthier. And there is no number, right? Some people can carry an extra 20, 30 pounds perfectly healthy, even more than that. Other people don't feel well with even an extra 10 or 15. So I'm not saying that fat is wrong or whatever we want to call fat. I'm just saying that if somebody doesn't want that to be their reality, it doesn't have to be because of the genetic piece.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of BMI either, I'm a pretty tall guy, and I'm probably one of those ones that can carry a little bit extra weight. But at the same time, getting back to BMI, if I was not just over that number that they say I should be, I think I would be able to clean drain pipes just with myself, because you know how skinny I would be. But at the same time, I also, this gets back to your awareness within your own body. I think we all can feel if we've put on a little bit more, And now things that we used to do are harder. Mm-hmm. And as you age, that's compounding it. And so for me, I found it myself is like, you know, for a while there, I used to, when I was younger, I used to lift a lot more weight, and I had a lot more muscle weight on. But even that, if you don't maintain it, can start to just be weight that can be tough to move around when you get older. And so now it's like, I want to be, you know, I want to have the training, but I also want to stay lean, because mm-hmm. I think staying lean is going to help in so many areas of life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, we all, but women more so, of course, lose muscle as we age. And I'm a big fan of muscle. It mm-hmm. allows me to walk around and lift groceries and play with my grandson. And
right, exactly.
Bike on my Peloton. And it also means that I'm burning more calories at rest if I have more muscle. So
absolutely.
As you said, staying lean, and we all want to stay active. So we got to keep doing the work.
Yeah. And I just think of elite athletes in whatever gender, as they get older, they have to work harder to mm-hmm. stay at that level. And mm-hmm. not that we have to kill ourselves, but we have to understand that as we get older, it's harder to stay at the same level. And so you have to be focused on that and making sure that you stay active so that
keeps
it staying easy. All right. I wanted to touch on one more thing.
Okay.
Because in my household, this is something that my wife deals with. I know her mother also deals with. And that's on the subject of thyroid.
Okay.
So thyroid testing, what's your take on thyroid testing? It seems like it almost seems like the area where you live, people are more susceptible to it. Have you found that to be the case? What is it about thyroid testing and the thyroid itself that makes it so prevalent?
So I'm thinking that you might be referring to hypothyroidism, which is not
enough,
is
correct.
Versus hyper, which
correct.
Is yep. less common. You know, I've read that there are areas of the world where there's more hypothyroidism, even countries. Certain countries have more and less. I don't know the statistics or anything to give you on that. But one thing I do know when it comes to testing is many doctors are not fluent in endocrinology, right? Endocrine system, the thyroid is a part of that. So is the pituitary, which works hand in hand with the thyroid. Then there's the adrenal glands. All of those work in concert, as does everything in the body, but those three especially. And if a doctor is used to giving a single test to test for thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, that's the most common one you get, the ranges for wellness within, you know, is like in some tests it's 2.5 to 5.5. Another lab might say 1.8 to 4.8. That's a huge range in there. And it's not the whole picture. First of all, TSH is not a thyroid hormone. It's put out by the pituitary. It's a stimulating thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. So are we testing the actual thyroid hormone as it's working in the body or not working? No, we're only testing whether the pituitary is saying, come on, I need more thyroid, or I don't have enough thyroid over here. So, and within the range, if a doctor says, well, you're in the normal range, you may not feel well because normal is not your normal, right? Normal is not your well, your happy place. So I encourage women to find a doc or to order them online. Nowadays, you can get almost anything tested online that is a total thyroid panel. It's like the cardiac panel we talked about before. Let's test the whole heart and let's test the whole thyroid, because you can have thyroid hormone circulating and not getting into the cells. Well, then you feel like crap, but you're only going to know that if you see what your T3 level is, T4, whether it's free, whether it's bound. So without getting too complicated, I encourage women who get a diagnosis just on a TSH, they still have sleeplessness or weight gain, or they're cold, or their hair's falling out. All those things are still there, even though the doctor says they're normal. I would encourage them to find a test and then find somebody who can read the test or take it back to your doctor. There are so many great websites out there. If you there's one called Stop the Thyroid Madness. She's been writing about this stuff for years and years and years. And I can tell you personally, my TSH level doesn't even register in the range, because in order for me to feel well, I have to be right on the border of the lowest number. It's just how I operate. Luckily, I found a doctor who was willing to work with me, because the doctor before him is like, I can't treat you. I'll get arrested. I'll get put in jail for malpractice. I was like, what? I didn't ask you, you know. Anyway, so again, rebellious. Women, take whatever little ounce of courage you can to go back to a doc and say, this isn't enough for me. I need some more testing. Or can you refer me to somebody who, and I have been to endocrinologists, just because there's a doctor in endo doesn't mean that they know the nuances of the thyroid either. But you're likely to find somebody that can help you with this, because there's no reason to suffer, to feel awful. Just no reason.
Got it. Very nice. Well, this has been a really good conversation, Gregory. Nice. For my listeners, what would you want them to be the takeaway from our conversation overall for what you want them to know about aging and wellness, for those that are maybe haven't hit the age of 50, maybe just over, or those that are well into that phase of life?
So here's what I would say, two things. One, midlife is the Olympics of change, whether it's your personal life, your life, your body. From then on, all you can expect is for things to change. And maybe it's always that way and I didn't notice it as much. So be flexible, roll with the punches, find a way to feel good about yourself, your life, your body. And the other thing I would say is definitely don't settle for this is all there is, this is what happens at your age. Tough titties, pardon my French. Go home. There's nothing wrong with you. If you don't feel well, find somebody that can help you find a way to feel well. Because you won't age well if you don't feel well now. It's not going to get better unless it gets taken care of. So be courageous. Find people that will support you. And let me know if I can help.
Very nice. Thank you, Gregory. That was good. I think that was a good sum up. Sometimes it's just continuing to ask the question, right? Yeah. And being not allowing yourself to be dismissed, but that's keep it. Asking that's the exactly. question and trying to find out more answers if yeah. you don't feel well. Exactly. Awesome. Well, again, her name is Gregory Ann Cox. She is rebellious when it comes to wellness over 50. So is that the best place for them to learn more about you, is your website?
Absolutely. And I have, as you mentioned earlier, I have the podcast. It's on all the platforms. I've interviewed some really interesting people about health and healthy aging.
All right. Well, this was a great conversation. Again, the website is rebelliouswellnessover50.com. Her name is Gregory Ann Cox. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, hope Dan. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us on our journey to learn about various topics. If you'd like to get in touch with the Dad Who Knows Nothing, connect with him at the Dad Who Knows Nothing on TikTok and Instagram, or Dad Knows Zero on Twitter. If you have a moment and you like this episode, drop us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Have a great day and enjoy your journey through this game called life.